Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point. In post-Nixon Washington, there was urgency for reform, for government to be trusted again. And to do that, there needed to be more transparency, a greater focus on the ethics demanded of those in public office, for clear lines between their government service and personal gain. Well, decades later, the appetite for ethics reform, for a hard look in the mirror, just isn't there in the same way. This hour in On Point, the history and the future of ethics in government. And with us from Washington, D.C. is Walter Schaub. He's the former director of the Office of Government Ethics and current senior advisor at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, which spells out CREW. Walter, welcome to the program.
Hello.
It's nice to talk with you again.
Yes, nice to be back.
Tell us about, first of all, about the office you used to direct, the Office of Government Ethics, how it came into being, what it can do and what it can't do.
So the Office of Government Ethics is part of a sweeping wave of reforms that came in 1978 in the post-Watergate era. And it was designed to help increase the ethical culture of government. Nothing that they created or empowered OGE to do would have directly stopped the Watergate crisis. But what it was intended to do was create a stronger ethical culture in government through financial disclosure and through monitoring conflicts of interest and regular ethics training. And, you know, the funny thing about ethics training is it's more important that you do it than what is actually said while you're doing it, because it forces government officials to sit down and focus on the importance of remembering that public service is a public trust and they're serving the people. And it worked pretty well for about four decades. The Office of Government Ethics has collected financial disclosure reports from top officials. You know, there are 26,000 government officials who file public financial disclosure reports and another 400,000 that file confidential financial disclosure reports. So there's an army of about 5,000 agency ethics officials doing the work, and OGE doesn't supervise all of them, but gives them guidance and directs their work. And OGE provides advice to top officials on how to avoid conflicts of interest. What OGE can't do, and what we've learned in the past 3 years is a terrible weakness, is it can't investigate, and it can't issue fines and penalties, and it can't force people to do things. And when you have an administration that's going to do anything that's legal, and maybe even some things that are illegal as long as there are no consequences, that's not a strong enough system.
There's also one federal officer who's not covered by its requirements, and that's the president.
Yes, and the vice president.
And so the two.
But
two.
Only one of them has been a problem lately.
Let's say that I'm nominated to be the U.S. Secretary of Fruit. And it turns out that I've had, maybe by inheritance, but I have a lot of stock in a company that sells bananas. I sit down. What do I have to do? How do I get in compliance in that case? Do I just disclose the fact that I'm a banana heir?
Right. You know, in the case of nominees, OGE gets working with them even before the public knows that they're being considered for the nomination, so that it lowers the stakes a little bit. And if that conflict becomes unresolvable, you can walk away without having done any damage. But OGE collects a financial disclosure report from that nominee and meets with them to explain, or meets with their representatives or through agency ethics officials, communicates to them that that fruit inheritance is going to be incompatible with the work of the job, and gets them to sign a financial an ethics agreement along with their financial disclosure report, pledging to divest that. And in fact, that has continued in this administration. President Trump's own nominees have been divesting financial interests, even though their boss thinks that there's no reason for him to do the same.
There's an interesting twist to divestiture, as I recall. If in divesting, I say, wait a minute, I have to sell all that banana stock. We've had it since I was a child. I'm going to realize a capital gain, a huge capital gain. It's treated differently than other capital gains if I'm doing it in the name of divestiture. Is that right?
Yes, there's a program that's intended to minimize the impact of coming into government as an answer to the question of people who say ethics is too hard and that's going to deter good people from coming into government. And it's called a certificate of divestiture. What it does is it leaves you in the status quo ante position you were before you were told you had to divest. You do have to sell, but if you roll it into something non-conflicting like diversified mutual funds, the capital gains will be deferred, and it'll be as though you never sold the asset, which some people have argued is a benefit, but the reality is you're no better or no worse off than you were before the government knocked on your door and told you to divest.
Let me give you another hypothetical, which is I'm nominated to be the Secretary of Fruit. I don't own any stock that conflicts in any way, but my son owns a ton of banana stock. And in fact, he may even run a big banana business. Are you going to tell me there's some problem with what my child is doing?
So there's a lot of people whose interests are imputed to you, including a spouse, a general partner, an outside employer. But an adult child is not one of them. A minor child is, but not an adult child. So we would not make that adult child divest their assets. We would, however, expect you not to do business with them in your official capacity so that you're sitting across the table from them.
My adult child wouldn't have to disclose, or I wouldn't have to disclose what my adult child owns?
That's right. And that's been consistent. We've treated Donald Jr. and Eric Jr. In the Trump family. You hear talk of Joe Biden's son. All of these individuals' children have been treated the same. They're completely separate from their adult parents.
Do you think there is a causality between transparency and ethical behavior in government? Or is there simply an atmosphere which makes one feel this is important, that you're supposed to be ethical and avoid conflicts of interest that's advanced by this process?
You know, I think transparency is an important piece of it, but it's not the end-all, be-all. In the executive branch, you actually have to also divest the financial interests. In Congress, on the other hand, they merely disclose on the theory that voters might be upset and vote their member of Congress out for a conflict of interest. I don't think that's a very realistic perception, but at least in the executive branch, they go further than mere disclosure required divestiture. But even in the cases where divestiture isn't required, I think disclosure is important because good government groups like CRU, the one I work for, or other good government groups out there, get a hold of these reports, and reporters get a hold of these reports, and they call these individuals out on potential conflicts of interest that maybe are technically legal but are wrong and are troubling to people. And in some cases, that produces divestiture. We saw that with Elaine Chao, who decided to keep stock in an asphalt company while she was Secretary of Transportation, and the agency insisted she wasn't going to work on anything that would affect it. But the public outcry forced her to follow through on an earlier commitment to divest it.
So the role of the public here is important.
Yes. And in fact, you know, we used to have visitors from foreign countries come to the Office of Government Ethics to study the ethics program and how it was in the U.S. that we had what at the time was considered the gold standard. I think we're now something of a laughingstock. But we were once the gold standard before this current president. And they would come, and the first thing I would tell these foreign officials is, you can't have an ethics program without a free press. And I believe that to this day, and I think we've seen the effects of a free press in holding some people accountable in the past 3 years.
Have you thought recently about what it would be like if, in fact, a candidate, you would want to apply this to candidates in the primaries as well, candidates before they're nominated by their parties, to have them be much more transparent. Would there be anyone whose finances would come close to resembling those of Michael Bloomberg?
Not that I'm aware of, no, although I don't think he's filed his financial disclosure report yet, so I don't think we even know the full extent of those. But I think across the board, the public and the media can be doing a better job of demanding answers from the president and from people who want to be president, asking them, what assets will you divest specifically? We have your financial disclosure report. Put a check mark next to each thing you're promising to divest. And I think it's crucial that people do that before a party picks a candidate, because I doubt that the average voter is going to change from one party to the other over a conflict of interest. But they might change from one candidate for a party's nomination to another because it doesn't require them to change party affiliation. And so I've been advocating since late 2017 that all candidates be required either by law or expected by the public to disclose their specific ethics plan, and not in vague terms, but specifically saying, what will I divest and by when?
Is it kind of missing a key locus of corruption here by looking at the personal finances of the federal officers as opposed to their campaign finances? That is, we all witnessed during the impeachment hearings Ambassador Sondland, who had given $1 million to the inaugural committee of President Trump and was made an ambassador. That's been going on for decades. I mean, this is and everyone, all both parties have done it routinely. But we do not believe that Mr. Trump benefited personally from the $1 million. He benefited politically, or his inauguration did. We wouldn't even look at that under these guidelines.
Yeah, it's my personal view that campaign finance law in this country is a threat to the republic itself. But it's not a problem that's going to be solved in the immediate future, because both parties have been guilty of taking donations from people who want to influence them. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important not to think that, okay, well, if we can't have this important reform, then nothing's worth doing, because we can, at least in the meantime, while continuing to push for campaign finance reform, demand that individuals entering government resolve their own personal conflicts.
We're hearing about the Office of Government Ethics and the desire for transparency when it comes to the finances of elected officials and also appointed officials. Plus, what will lead the public battle between the White House and a longtime civil servant? I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Robert Siegel. A government office doing a job so mundane that for decades most Americans may not have known it existed. When Donald Trump was elected president, the work of that office, the Office of Government Ethics, became a test of the systems in place to fight corruption. Joining us from Washington is Walter Schaub. He is the former director of the Office of Government Ethics and current senior advisor to Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. CREW. Welcome back, Walter. And I'll note here that your judgment of the Trump administration's ethics record has evolved when you criticized him. Former Utah Congressman Jason Chaffetz was the head of the House Oversight Committee when President Trump took office in 2017. And he went on this week with George Stephanopoulos right before Trump's inauguration. When he was asked about Trump's plan to divest, he said this.
Well, the president-elect has a duty and obligation to abide by the law, and he is exempt from most all of these laws. He has done a financial disclosure, which has gone through the Office of Government Ethics. I think he's done that twice. That is his duty under the law. I hear no complaints about that. My question is about the head of the Office of Government Ethics. Is he acting ethically when he sent out 9 tweets praising Donald Trump, saying that his plan was brilliant? How did he come to that conclusion? And how does he come to his current conclusions, having never done an investigation and never looked at the paperwork in the point where he can actually come to a reasonable conclusion?
Well, Tushab, he's talking about you. Is that accurate that you had applauded then President-elect Trump's plan for divestiture?
No, of course not. What I had said was that I would applaud divestiture, that divestiture would be terrific. He had told the public that morning that he was going to resolve all conflicts of interest, which, of course, can only be done through divestiture. And so we decided to take him at his word to nudge him in the direction of divestiture. It's a shame that Chairman Chaffetz, who had so much to say about individuals in the Obama administration and who hinted at impeaching Hillary Clinton over what he perceived as conflicts of interest with her nonprofit foundation, suddenly changed his mind and became a big fan of conflicts of interest in the Trump administration and spent more time worrying about the propriety of social media tweets sounding the alarm. At a time when the Office of Government Ethics was really the canary in the coal mine for what we're seeing right now, because knowing that President Trump was going to put his own interests first put us on a path to the Ukraine episode, where he attempted to coerce a foreign government into interfering in our election for his own personal benefit. So there's a theme that runs through everything he's done.
But in fairness to former Congressman Chaffetz, you too have evolved in your views of these things. We spoke when you quit as head of the Office of Government Ethics, for all things considered, way back then. And I remember you would go no further than saying you were disappointed in the Trump administration's ethics plan. You've gone a long way from being disappointed. I mean, you're extremely critical. You're talking about what, heads on pikes at this point.
Yeah, I have, and it's broken my heart. You know, I thought it was one of the worst things I'd ever seen in 2017, when the ethical problems in this administration were more than the Office of Government Ethics could handle, and I had to leave in protest. I still at that point had some real faith in Republican members of Congress who had championed pursuing conflicts of interest or perceived conflicts of interest against Hillary Clinton's nonprofit. And I thought surely they would have an interest in the current president's for-profit company. Unfortunately, they broke my heart over 2 years not divesting. And last January in 2019, Mark Meadows and I had a rather animated exchange in a congressional hearing where he asked why it was that I once opposed OGE having investigative authority and was at that point endorsing it. And what I explained to him was that I continued to oppose it after I left the Office of Government Ethics and President Trump was in office. I still thought that that was not a necessary measure because I thought Congress would conduct its constitutional responsibility of oversight. But 2 years later, I was convinced that they were never going to do that and somebody had to do it. So I felt it was the Office of Government Ethics. And things have continued to get worse since then.
Before we turn to some phone callers, some listeners, I want to put one further hypothetical to you, which will, extending what I said earlier, may mystify those who've just tuned in. Let's say that I'm nominated to be Secretary of Fruit, and I completely divest my, or I don't even have any stock in any banana company or any other related business. But after I leave office, I become chief lobbyist for the American Banana Association. Have I violated federal ethics?
So interestingly, the post-employment restrictions on federal officials don't tend in most cases to focus on what job you can take. Instead, they focus on what contacts you can have with the federal government. So just taking that job would not necessarily be a violation under the laws or the rules if you have no contact with the federal government for 2 years. Under the Trump Ethics Pledge, which they don't seem very interested in enforcing and are handing out waivers like candy, you would technically have even broader restrictions on contacts with the government on behalf of this outside entity. But again, there's nothing that would prohibit you from taking the job.
Would a candidate's plan to clear financial conflicts of interest influence your vote? Do conflicts of interest affect the faith that you have in government? Chris is on the line from Lake Mills, Iowa. Hi, Chris.
Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I just wanted to say that earlier comment from the gentleman was that since Trump has come into office, that somehow he's diminished the ethics of the office. And that's an entirely untrue statement. And the common sense people of Iowa know that, and this is not in defense of Trump, but the common sense people of Iowa know that that's not true, because the Bushes had several business interests, the Clintons as well. So I just wanted to make a statement that to say that Trump has somehow diminished, the ethics of what a sitting president should follow since he came into office is totally untrue. You can give lots of examples about what he's done, but you can also go back and give examples of previous presidents.
What do you think about that, Walter?
And the fact that, for some reason, the mainstream media is protecting this Hunter Biden character. So I just think it's an untrue statement. And I think the people of Iowa understand that.
I don't know if the mainstream media is protecting Hunter Biden, but Walter Shaw, what's your answer to Chris's comments?
So, I think what's really telling about that comment is that information about conflicts of interest isn't permeating the entire country. And it's hard to figure out how to reach the people who are either not listening or are saying that government has always been corrupt. So what difference does it make? In fact, President Bush's financial disclosure report and President Clinton's financial disclosure reports can be found online. And you can go through them and look at the assets that they hold, and you won't be able to identify a significant asset that involved something that they did directly that you could call a conflict of interest. Meanwhile, we have this president using his office to promote his business, spending well. I mean, he long ago left the $100 million mark going to visit his office, his properties, bringing foreign dignitaries there. He even at one point awarded himself the G7 summit conference for this coming or later this year until the public outcry was so great that he had to stop.
And if he had done that, if he had gone ahead and done that and had the G7 summit at the Miami Golf Course at the Doral, would he have been violating any law or simply offending a public sentiment?
Well, he would have violated the Constitution's emoluments clauses when his property received money from the U.S. government for that contract. And of course, he's facing litigation over the foreign emoluments clauses. That would be the domestic emoluments clause. It also would literally be the worst kind of conflict of interest you could ever imagine a world leader engaging in, short of soliciting a foreign government to interfere in our elections, because you are simply saying, I'm using my control of the government to hand myself money. You're reaching into the treasury and taking money out of it for yourself. Mm-hmm. I don't think you could come up with a more clear-cut conflict of interest and violation of the public's trust than if he had gone through with that.
James is on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. James, what's your question or comment?
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is for Mr. Schaub. So previously in the conversation, you had mentioned that a clear and free press was necessary as a mechanism to help improve accountability. And it seems like with the current administration, the test on what the present mechanisms are has been pretty thorough. So do you have any suggestions or thoughts of what new or future mechanisms might be needed for future administrations to help ensure accountability?
Yeah, that's a great question and a really challenging one, because we already have the First Amendment to the Constitution, and presidents should be steering really far clear of anything that would chill free speech. But you've seen this administration recently excluding CNN anchors from a meeting with network anchors before the State of the Union address. You've seen them try to pull credentials from people. You've seen them shut down the idea of having press conferences and instead meeting only with their favorite network, Fox News, which is increasingly becoming akin to state media because they're only repeating the administration's talking points. At the same time, you've seen some great investigative journalism, and you've seen reporters uncover tremendous conflicts of interest and other problems that really, I think, have activated a lot of energy on the part of the public to get engaged in their democracy in a way they never have before. I guess if I had one request for the press, I think it would be to recognize that we are in completely uncharted territory. The Republic itself is under assault, and I think they need to start using language reflective of that rather than in some ways normalizing things by talking about it in terms that sound like something maybe President Bush or President Reagan or President Obama did was in any way comparable.
Walter Schaub, is it fair to say that the Supreme Court has not exactly been a bulldog on your side in this issue, that Justice Scalia some years ago wrote in Morrison v. Olson that the Republic had been permanently encumbered with an institution that will do it great harm, when he was speaking of independent prosecutors and ethics organizations. In the McDonald, the case of the Virginia governor, McDonald, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that governor takes gifts, sets up meetings. That's what people in office do. That's not a public. It's not an official act. It seems as though the courts have been a lot more pragmatic about this than you would want them to be.
Yeah, or I'd go so far as to say naive. I think you've got judges who are doing their best, but their life experience isn't the same as government officials and private sector individuals have been. I think the McDonald decision, which made it much harder to bring a bribery charge against somebody and could be read to mean you can go ahead and pay somebody for a meeting. By the way, don't. There might be other laws involved.
You can give them a Rolex, actually.
Right. I think, unfortunately, that overlooks the fact that there's a multi-billion-dollar industry that focuses specifically on getting access to government officials. The lobbyists in Washington make their bread and butter showing up and getting access to individuals. So saying that access is not something that the bribery law should cover, I think is dangerous and naive. I think Congress could have tools to write laws that more clearly articulate what they're after, and maybe the courts would be more willing to apply those. Mm-hmm. I do think for so far the judiciary, though, has held up not consistently but very well, not in every case, but very well under this current assault. Right. And you've got an emergency meeting of federal judges happening today trying to decide how they're going to respond to the president appearing to interfere in prosecutions.
We're talking about ethics in government, and there's something that happens in Washington. People who haven't worked in or around the Capitol may not be familiar with it, but a congressman or a senator does his legislative business in his Capitol Hill office. When it comes time to raise money, which a member of the House might do roughly every week, they'll go across the street to another office that is not part of their congressional office and make calls to donors. And in that trip across the street, they have effected a legal separation between their legislative work and their fundraising. It's always seemed to me to be a pretty thin guarantee that there is no conflict between the two activities. Does it make sense to you?
I think if we see government as an institution designed to protect people not only from foreign aggression in terms of invading marauders, but also internally, they keep the airplanes from falling out of the skies. They keep the roads being built so that we can get places and commerce can thrive. an important function of government is to protect the weak from the strong. And when the government is populated by elected officials who depend on the wealthy and the corporations to put them in their offices and keep them there, they become beholden to the strong in a way that undermines their effectiveness in protecting the rest of us. And I think that's sort of a breach of the social compact that needs to be addressed. The idea somehow that it's free speech to give gobs of money to candidates and influence them directly or indirectly is, I think, naive in the sense that it overlooks that that speech of the well-funded is drowning out everyone else's speech. And there is no marketplace of ideas where everybody's ideas gets heard when the people with the most powerful voices are drowning out everyone else. And so I do tend to think of our campaign finance situation in this country as a threat to democracy.
We're hearing about money, conflicts of interest, and personal profits from government service, and one ethics expert's plan to improve transparency so that voters understand candidates' conflicts before they go to the ballot box. He's Walter Schaub. I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cuneo was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country, but it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Robert Siegel. There's an appetite in the country for running government more like a business. In fact, that was a key to President Trump's campaign message in 2016. But when it comes to ethics, there's a distinction between the two, or at least some say there should be. And to discuss this, we have Walter Schaub with us. He's the former director of the Office of Government Ethics and current senior advisor at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, CREW. And Walter, first I want to play for you what turned out to be a moment when the line between business, family, and politics, that's multiple lines, all seem to be crossed on Fox and Friends. In February 2017, Kellyanne Conway was on that show, and she openly endorsed Ivanka Trump's clothing line, which led people to question whether she'd violated ethics rules.
It's a wonderful line. I own some of it. I'm going to give a free commercial here. Go buy it today, everybody. You can find it online.
And now on the line with us is Weston from Charleston, South Carolina, who evidently still remembers that moment quite vividly. Weston?
Oh, yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think this presidency has taken advantage of nepotism and their family to skim money from all conceivable locations. I mean, he's used Ivanka in China right when they're negotiating our tariffs to get copyrights. And I understand Ivanka was paid directly from the inauguration committee as well. And the two sons are on the reelection campaign. It's like he's got three bad men, or four if you count her husband, out there gathering up, you know, money, deals, and influence on his behalf. What do you think about the children's involvement, and what kind of ethics are involved when you, I mean, they accuse Hunter Biden of getting a cushy job off of his dad, which is probably not far from the truth, but what about these kids, and what about how he charges us for his trips and his golf and that type of thing?
Well, Walter Schaub, as you would imagine, a better regime for governing conflicts of interest, would there be some way of controlling the ways in which close families are benefiting from government service?
Absolutely. You know, in terms of the nepotism in the White House, the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel cleared the way for that by issuing an opinion on January 20th, 2017, saying that Jared Kushner could be hired in the White House. But to do that, it had to reverse at least four prior opinions that we know of over the half century of life of that statute. So I think We're already in a zone where the Department of Justice and the White House are twisting notions of what types of controls there already are in place and just kicking down obstacles to any kind of corruption that they want. We've seen in the case of Jared Kushner that an individual who's had trouble getting a security clearance and has had trouble filing accurate disclosures with the government was retained in an extremely sensitive position, then was accused of using an app, WhatsApp, on a private phone to communicate with the Saudi government. Through an app, by the way, that the Saudi government is accused of having planted spyware on Jeff Bezos's phone. So you see a level of danger walking through the door and conflicts of interest in that case become a national security threat. And I think that contributed to the White House's failure to deny dozens of other security clearances to individuals who were brought into the White House with suspected problems, because they didn't want to hold them to a higher standard and embarrass the president's son-in-law. So I think we see a trickle-down effect of this conflict.
Is that still the case, by the way? Or has the White House staff gotten in order with their security clearances?
You know, there's so little transparency. Yeah. We don't know for sure. We've heard reports that politicals are overruling career officials who are typically much stricter on these things.
But I remember at the beginning of the Clinton administration, there was a problem with the very slow process of applying for security clearances. There were lots of people who in positions where you would assume they would have had it and didn't get it. I mean, this has been a problem before.
Yes, I don't think on this magnitude. But you see, in the Clinton administration, they had the Travelgate scandal where they were accused of taking certain actions that were questionable. And the public was outraged at the time. And if we were applying the same standards to this administration, I think we'd all get worn out from outrage exhaustion, because on a daily basis, they are virtually committing the kinds of acts that would have ended or at least jeopardized any past administration. It's now coming at us like through a fire hose, and it's hard to keep up.
Perry is on the line. Perry is calling from Galesburg, Illinois. Hi.
Thank you for taking my question.
Certainly.
Or my comment. Our current president, as you refer to him, I remember clearly that he promised, and I will say again, promised, he would release his tax returns. I believe it was before the Republican convention. If I were running for president, I would ask him every day about his tax returns that he promised to release. Thank you.
Walter Schaub, would you require candidates for office to release their tax returns?
Absolutely. And I'd go further and require that they not just release the summary pages, as some candidates are doing right now, but release the entire thing, as other candidates have done with their worksheets and all, so that we can see the sources of income. I think in the problem of President Trump, though, the tax returns are only going to tell part of the story if we ever do see them, because the question of the liabilities of his businesses are potentially a source of far bigger danger than even his sources of income. And that wouldn't necessarily be included in anything that he would file. It would be the company's conflicts of interest.
Pam is on the line from Bettendorf, Iowa. And I believe Pam wants to comment on our previous Iowa caller.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
Yes. The reason I called is the good person that formerly called in. I don't agree with much of what he said about us good people in Iowa, so that got me dialing the phone.
You're calling for us good people in Iowa. He was speaking for common sense Iowans.
Okay, well, I'll go. Yes, thank you. But my concern is that's the average person in Iowa. I have two senators that I don't agree with much on, and so when you said the public should do more, I've written letters, I've called their office, I've gone to local protests, if you will. The one day they knew we were coming, the office was closed. We write letters, we get form responses. I'm not part of the donor class of the Republican Party. So I'm not sure how to get their attention. So that's my question.
Well, and let me sharpen the point on that question, Walter, which is everybody heard Donald Trump promise to release his taxes and make a rather odd claim that he's under perpetual audit, that he's always being audited and has been told that you can't release your tax forms when you're under audit. I don't think that was very, very persuasive for most people, but it didn't get in the way of his being elected. This issue doesn't seem to have huge traction with the voters. So politicians might feel free. Senators Ernst and Chuck Grassley from Iowa might feel that you're not going to lose any election by someone not complying with these concerns.
I think that members of Congress right now who are defending the president and who recently acquitted him of possibly the worst conduct any American president has even come close to committing are reading the polls. And they're deciding whether their voters in the House of Representatives in highly gerrymandered districts or in the Senate in their individual states are going to support them. And they have forgotten that they represent the entire country, or at least all the people in their state or their district, and not just the ones that they can count on for votes. I think they've turned a blind eye to something that CREW, my organization, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, has been tracking. We have a conflicts tracker online that shows, as of today, we've tracked 2,961 conflicts, 77 political events, including 14 foreign government events, 456 visits by Trump to his property, 134 foreign officials visiting his property, and terrifyingly, 121 members of Congress who are supposed to be conducting oversight visiting his property. And I think it's extremely important for us to stay focused on that because that's the level of risk and danger we face. But I think there's another side to this, too. I think the populace is highly engaged. I think people like Pam are my hero right now because the need to fight for democracy and oppose corruption, which is incompatible with democracy, has never been greater, and the threats have never been greater. But the public response has also never been greater. And I think it's hard sometimes to report on them because it's easier to report on maniacs screaming at reporters and shaking their fists and giving them the finger at Trump rallies. It's much easier to report on that than somebody like Pam who's showing up at protests or one of her neighbors who's writing 300 postcards to prospective voters encouraging them to show up. Or other people have gone out and gotten trained on how to register people to vote. And I think we're in a time where two of our three safeguards have failed us. The Electoral College failed us. It was supposed to keep somebody who might be a demagogue or disrespectful of the rule of law from getting into the White House. Well, it has kept and then we've seen.
Well, but the Electoral College was supposed to also keep the people from electing the president. It was designed to be an elitist institution, and that hasn't been the case for over a century, well over a century. I want to return to this issue of emoluments. You've remarked on how had the G8 met at the Doral Country Club, a golf course resort that Trump owns, that would have been a gross violation of the emoluments clause of the Constitution. It was raised when, I guess, the Kuwaitis moved their National Day ceremonies to Trump's hotel in Washington. During an October 2019 cabinet meeting, President Trump expressed his frustration to reporters over what he called the phony emoluments clause as he responded to criticism of his now canceled plan to have the next G7 summit at his own Miami resort.
Other presidents, if you look, other presidents were wealthy. Not huge wealth. George Washington was actually considered a very, very rich man at the time. But they ran their businesses. George Washington, they say, had two desks. He had a presidential desk and a business desk. I don't think you people with this phony emoluments clause. And by the way, I would say that it's cost me anywhere from $2 to $5 billion to be president. And that's okay between what I lose and what I could have made. I would have made a fortune if I just ran my business. I was doing it really well.
It was President Trump on what he might have made, he says. Walter Schaub, listening to any discussion of what President Trump called the phony emoluments, it exists. I mean, there is an emoluments clause. There's no question about that. But, you know, it probably doesn't help the cause that it's labeled with an 18th century word. It's labeled with a word that probably none of us has ever used in any context other than describing the Emoluments Clause. Therefore, it enters the discussion with a suspicion of it being antique in some way.
You know, the same people who are calling it antique are very excited about the Second Amendment, which talks about well-regulated militias. There's lots of old-fashioned language in our Constitution.
No, but
that's the nature of
but well-regulated and militias. Well-regulated militias are at least part of common discourse. They're still part of the common vocabulary today.
Are they? Do you know of a lot of militias? The point is that
all over the Middle East, we talk about them all the time.
But not here.
Not well regulated. Yeah.
The point is, it's part of the common parlance because there are a lot of people pursuing gun rights or gun control, and it's been a focus of discussion. The Emoluments Clause hasn't been a focus of discussion in the general public because it hasn't had to be. You haven't had presidents doing what this president does, but it is something that people are very familiar with in the government. We had presidential nominees in more than one administration who had to have Emoluments Clause issues resolved before they could go forward. We've had inspector general investigations of nominees and public officials for Emoluments Clause issues. And there's actually an office at the Department of Defense that applies a statutory exception in certain cases and reviews applications to accept foreign payments because retired military officers remain covered by it. So while it's unfamiliar to the general public, it's a part of regular life inside the federal government. And the president is just coming from an outside culture that doesn't respect the Constitution.
One thing that I recall you found problematic with the Trump administration's dealings with the Office of Government Ethics was the number of waivers that were granted to people that exempted them, at least for a time, for complying, or in some cases, retroactively exempted them from compliance.
Right. Yeah, and there's no such thing as a retroactive waiver. A retroactive waiver is papering over a violation, because if you do something that a rule prohibits without a waiver, you have violated a rule. The idea of issuing retroactive waivers was invented by this White House to paper over violations that they had.
Are we talking about a half dozen cases, or are we talking about many waivers that were granted?
Well, we don't know, because a number of their waivers are issued to categories of people, which I've also never seen, because the idea of a waiver is usually your unique circumstances warrant something. I tend to think the bigger problem is the more across the board failure to follow the ethics rules. You mentioned Kellyanne Conway earlier, a Trump appointee who heads an agency called the Office of Special Counsel, no mm-hmm. relation to Mueller, mm-hmm. Recommended her termination for repeated Hatch Act violations. And that's just being ignored. So you can have a rule on the book, but if the president's not going to enforce it, you don't even need a waiver. You just simply ignore the law.
We've been hearing from Walter Schaub this hour. He's the former director of the Office of Government Ethics. He's now a senior advisor at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Walter, nice to talk with you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Eileen Imada, Brittany Knotts, Stefano Katsonis, Wes Martin, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from Liam Knox, Caroline Love, and Bradley Noble. I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated. and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.